Thank you. You asked, CQ.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh. This is very exciting and a beautiful, beautiful theater. Yeah. Well, I really just want to get down to it. We have Megan Smith, the Chief Technology Officer of the United States of America.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul.
Makes me want to work on my title a little bit. It's very impressive.
It's a cool title.
So I think that's a good place to start. What does the CTO of the United States do?
Yeah, so this is a job that President Obama actually started with this administration. And the official role is assist the president and his team to harness the power of data, innovation, and technology on behalf of the American people. And we're embedded at the Office of Science Technology Policy, which is where the president's science advisor is, Vannevar Bush early on, now an amazing Dr. Holdren, John Holdren. And that team that we're embedded with really covers all the science and tech of government. So you can imagine the energy environment group that works with the Department of Energy. The president was just in the Arctic, so they're working on that. They're working on climate change. They're working in those areas. There's a group that works on science, so Ebola response, antimicrobial resistance, STEM education, astronomy night that's coming up on October 19th, those topics. There's a group that works on national security and international affairs, cyber, threats, bio, our relationships whenever we're talking with Brazil or India, and then a group that does tech and innovation, which has the Brain Initiative, AI things, entrepreneurship, and those areas, NASA policy. So we don't actually have to cover those topics and really do that. That team is doing that with us. We're embedded really as almost a policy and disruption or advance team. And the president just really wanted a small team that could capacity build the government in the way that he saw through the election, the way the technology is here, the way that Silicon Valley brings. How can we bring the best innovation into the government at any given time? So we work across all topics, and it's an incredible role, and I'm really honored to be doing it on behalf of all of you.
And you're the third CTO, so you're kind of the Thomas Jefferson.
I guess that's
pretty,
an honor.
Pretty good. John Adams,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
No, Todd Park was great.
Yeah. We love Todd Park. He's incredible.
So, you know, you've been in the role for a year now. Mm-hmm. You've come from Silicon Valley, and I want to talk more about your background and where you've come from. But what have you learned going to Washington? Mm-hmm. What have you been able to push this first year? What have you found to be better than expected, maybe a little bit harder than expected?
Yeah, so what's been incredible is the welcome that we receive. I went together with Alex McGilvery, who was the general counsel at Twitter. He's a coder lawyer, so we kind of take on policy things. We take on digital government and structuring that. We're also working on getting more of the American people into the work that we all, the kind of world we're all in. How do we get more of the American people in there? I've found just welcome and amazing talent. The issue that we have is that our talents, our tech talents, are a little more rare there. There are, of course, technical people in government, so NASA, you know, NIH, the National Institute of Health, but maybe in the rest of the government, there's not as strong the kind of tech that we're talking about, this open source innovation tech that we see in Silicon Valley. So getting that there, we're rare, and so it's been really important to team up, and people have been really welcome. But I found just people are doing extraordinary work. I mean, if you look at even, you know, it's been controversial, healthcare.gov and ACA, but 16 million Americans now have healthcare through very hard work on policy, very hard work on business models, putting this together, a very difficult time with the website and learning, you know, how we should rethink that. And here we are, you know, up we go. The hard work on the Iran deal. You know, I didn't know anything about things like that in detail. I mean, as an American citizen, I'm paying attention, but the heavy lifting to get to the point where we made that deal, just everything they're doing is like this curve, and it's very exciting to be part of that.
What's your view, I mean, especially on healthcare.gov, which is an interesting, I guess, case study, because, you know, it's famously right when it was built, it seemed like it wasn't built well.
Mm-hmm.
And then it seemed like this dream team from Silicon Valley shows up, a lot of folks with very similar backgrounds to yourself, folks mm-hmm. from Google, et cetera. And, you know, this team of 20 or so folks seemed to fix it.
Right.
And so to some degree, it's it's very easy to get cynical about it. This mm-hmm. big project wasn't working at first, but it's also kind of neat and hopeful that a small team was able to fix it. What's your view of that? Is it, you know, do you view kind of the negative side, wow, this thing, all of these resources were spent and it wasn't working right? Or does it point to a direction that we should be going in?
It actually speaks to the president's strategy with bringing our job and this kind of thing. What we had accidentally done is we kind of took the tech seat. We have, if you think about government, we have a surgeon general, we have justices. You know, if you're a lawyer on your resume, you will go work in government. Typically, you'll see some kind of clerking. And so we rotate all different Americans in and out of government at all levels. But actually, the tech job, this digital job, is not really at the principal level. And so people were having to make decisions without that teammate. And so that chair was kind of empty, and that's what the president's doing, is bringing that person. And in the healthcare.gov situation, you know, we had this extraordinary set of contractors, but there wasn't someone in the government who was technical in the way we are architecting and planning that, the way that a commercial CEO, if you're the CEO of Walmart or Target or something, you have your CTO or CIOs right with you. They're often in board meetings with you. They're right there. You know what happened. You have dashboards and that. And we had just not executed in that particular way, and something the president has been fixing. It started early. Todd Park actually was part of bringing the first wave of technical Americans in the form of a Presidential Innovation Fellow. We just signed the executive order of that, so we've made it permanent. This is the 50th anniversary of the White House Fellows, and so now we have these tech fellows, design thinkers in that. Last year, there were 28 of them in government working on all different kinds of things, Blue Button, getting our healthcare data out, working on veteran affairs, a lot of design thinking. So that group came in. And then from that, they got the idea, we need sort of a web shop inside of government. Mm. And so that's how 18F was born, which is in the General Services Administration. They're on 18th and F, so that's their name. So there's this great group of about 100 people now who have come from Silicon Valley. They're actually here and just across from Twitter, sort of over on the other side of City Hall, there's a San Francisco group here. And then after the healthcare.gov issue, in addition to the central group that any of the agencies could draw from, we also decided to make the United States Digital Service, which Mikey Dickerson came to run, and Haley Van Dyke is the number two there. And now there's teams in the VA, in working on immigration, in working on Department of Ed. I don't know if people see the college scorecard launch out of the Department of Ed? So that was done by Lisa Galopter, who was part of the Shockwave team, went into Hulu, then ran BET Digital, and so she's come to be the lead of the U.S. Digital Service in the Department of Education.
So what's the role? It's not, you know, as the CTO, your predecessor was Todd Park, and now you're in the role. Is the role, wow, we see that there's a need for tech talent or tech infrastructure in this part of the government, we're going to drop in and make it happen, and then someone else takes it over, and then that, or are you on a day-to-day basis involved in a lot of these things? Or neither?
Both. So sometimes in the beginning, you're piloting something, you're working very closely together with people. We work a lot on policy, so things like net neutrality, or right now we're working on encryption, we're working on open education resources, a lot of different topics of the day, patent reform, copyright. But in this sort of instigation part, it's really about collaborating with whoever it is you're capacity building. And diving with them. So an example would be working with the Department of Labor. Right now we have 5 million jobs open in the United States, and we have 500,000 of those are in tech, and they're all over the country. They pay 50% more than the average American private sector job. So what's going on with supply and demand? Why aren't we filling those? And so you're going in with the teams and saying, how do we do this? And what we discovered in this particular case that a few of the cities had solved the problem, or were working on it. So St. Louis, Louisville, Philly, New York, and actually the state of Delaware. The employers there, in some cases, were working on opening up to a different kind of resume. So in addition to the 4-year degree holder and the 2-year degree holder, they were open to hiring someone off a tech boot camp the 3 months in. We had tech boot camps coming, and then we had workforce development folks in Louisville. Code Louisville was busy trying to matchmake. And so this little mini ecosystem was developing in certain cities. We brought them to the White House, and with our Department of Labor and other colleagues, the National Economic Council folks, and we just got them debugging and working how they would work together. And then we figured out how to get more cities to witness that, kind of a coalition of the willing. And then we had 21 cities join, and we launched the program. We just had 10 more cities. Oakland just joined.
So just to make sure I'm fully understanding all of what your role does, there's a lot of folks in the government who are very focused on one particular problem. They're working on a site to fix this or a site to fix that.
Right.
And it sounds like the role of the CTO gets to take a more holistic view and see where there are gaps that need to be filled. It could either be instigate a team to form and build that capacity.
Or bring a certain kind of American who's missing and structure in a permanent way, like the Presidential Innovation Fellows as entrepreneurs in residence, 18F as a central capacity team in general services, USDS now embedded. Jeff Bezos has had an extraordinary employee, Kim, who's now the head of the U.S. Digital Service for the Department of Justice. So these incredible Americans, if we're the country that can make Amazon and Facebook and Twitter and all these things, we need them to be in our government in tours of duty. And so this particular move, as you're saying, from the CTO team is how do we structure with colleagues, the OMB team and others, and support them to have this capacity. Sometimes we'll be working more with the cities. So for example, last year, again, the Department of Labor was releasing $22 million for summer jobs for high school kids. And so we suggested for Baltimore was one of the target cities. We suggested instead of the kids doing the traditional summer job of picking up trash or clerking, how about coding?
Yeah.
And we were able, because we can see the coding teammates in Baltimore, we're like, here's a program, why don't you guys meet? And we were able to get tons of kids into, hundreds of kids into coding summer jobs for 2.5 weeks learning, 2.5 weeks building websites on behalf of businesses that were affected in the uprising. And so that changes their lives.
Wow.
Right? So can we, now that we learned that in Baltimore, do that in more cities and more cities and more cities? So almost like movement building.
There's a lot of
innovation way.
Figuring out gaps in the government and making sure they're filled, and then amplifying good work that people are doing so that they broaden.
Or coalition building, and then because we're government, so we make policy, we might be able to rule make.
Yeah.
So right now we're exploring the open source policy for government.
And
so we do that as Coalition of the Willing, or we've just done some things with FOIA where a couple
what
of the
agents,
the Freedom of Information Act.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you ask the government to release something, we should post it. And so we're practicing that with about 7 agencies. And then once that we've debugged and learned how to do that, we could make it a rule for everyone.
And
that would come out of the Department of Justice doing that. So it's the person who has the legal jurisdiction, DOJ in this case, would then review that and decide, but we can bring this new capacity, this best practice to them.
Wow. And what do you see, your personal goals for your time in office? What do you hope to, your legacy? I mean, you probably don't think in those terms, but, when future historians say, oh, Megan Smith, when she was CTO, this happened.
I really care a lot about unlocking talent and getting people to have access to, so I think a little bit about how do we, here's an example, connectivity is something we're really focused on, broadband connectivity. We have connectivity deserts in our country. We have places where the internet's just missing, or, Native American land, tribal, rural areas, classrooms, urban poor children who don't have broadband access. 20% of the kids in this country can't do their homework. They can't watch Khan Academy. That's
tragedy.
Serious tragedy. Come on. So how do we fix that? And our colleagues are doing extraordinary work. The FCC has done, for example, the President's Connect Ed program, where we've opened up E-rate and modernized that. E-rate is a way that people can apply, like for the classroom grants, so that you can get connectivity to your school and into your classroom. Yeah. But then we can come in with design thinking and say, hey, this website is requiring us to hire a consultant to do it. Should we really have every school district doing that? Fix the website. We can kind of go into the schools and do our design thinking and say, what's your experience of doing that? Understand a couple specific ones and then put a reference design up. So we're busy setting up to do that. So it's that last mile of implementation and then figure out how to let everyone do it, scale it.
And that's, I think, just this unlocking talent, spreading access. What do you see as the future of the role? This was a role that was created by President Obama. Is this something that you think the next president, if there is a change in parties, that they will continue with? And where do you see you know, 20 or 30 years in the future that people will reflect on this role? What will it be doing and what will be the impact of it?
A lot of companies have a CTO role too. I think it's the advanced team. Mm-hmm. In the case of this government job, it's not only advanced, but it's also a policy job. So you're busy doing, like I said, net neutrality. And I call right now, you know how there's IQ and EQ, I call it TQ, like tech skills. Mm-hmm. And so we're bringing TQ to the policy table with incredible colleagues, economists and lawyers and communicators who are awesome. We don't know what to do without them. But they need us to. And so we're bringing people like Ed Felton and Alex McGilvery and others to that table to be computer scientists when we're deciding net neutrality together with economists and others. So I think that will continue, and whatever the edge of technology is, the CTO team should be on that in the policy side and in the instigation side. An example this weekend, it was an incredible experience to be at the UN as we ratified the Sustainable Development Goals. So now we have 17 goals that the world leaders have worked together, ending poverty and 15 years. And so if you all get involved, it could be shorter, so please do that. What we wanted to do is teach new tricks. So back in this capacity building, we created an event on Sunday night after the leadership ratified. And on Sunday night, we held the Solutions Summit. So in our wacky web way, what we did was in August, we posted a form on the web. And we said, anybody out in the world already have solutions or in progress to some of these goals? And we leveraged the other science and tech ministries. So Brazil, Estonia, Kenya, Chile all helped us get the word out. We used the Ashoka Fellows, TED, Skoll, and others. We got over 800 proposals from 90 countries in an open web forum. And beautiful stuff. And so 14 women and men from six continents took the stage at the UN and did lightning talks, 3-minute TED talks, like TED-like talks, about, you know, a team using drones to plant 1 billion trees a year. Wow. A team from Uganda that has 90% of the people in Uganda have no access to a lawyer, so they're actually teaching law school in prison. Awesome. There's a guy from Nigeria, stood for 5 hours to get his visa. We finally got him there. He has 2 million listeners on the radio, and he's figured out how to kind of do an Airbnb for refrigerator storage at the market.
Wow.
So awesome. So, you know, because if you have these tomatoes and the sun is shining and you're like gone in 2 days, if you have this refrigerator that you can share for 25 or 50 cents, 21 days. Like night and day on the economic impact on your family and your future. So people out there all over the planet, we had people from everywhere. There was a Baidu Recycle team that was doing kind of like the shipped, you know, Uber. They would come pick up electronic devices and do a much better, much healthier recycling of them. Just really creative stuff. There's a floating fab lab in the Amazon that's so beautiful. So Solution Summit, you should see the
video. It's like a barge that floats on the Amazon.
And it's so beautiful. It's designed, it looks like a flower, like a floating little pod boat, and it has little pods that go off. And it's from Neil Gershenfeld's class at MIT, how to make almost anything, that started the Fab Lab movement. There's, you know, hundreds of Fab Labs.
And Fab Labs, for folks who don't know, these are labs where you can literally build anything using it.
Yeah, it's like shop class meets, you know, 3D printing and, you know, materials and fabric. And there's low-end and high-end ones, and this is one. And there's really amazing locally relevant things going on the Amazonian Fab Lab that include biomimicry and design and artisans and the advanced, you know, the high-end bio investigation, just fabulous. And so capacity building anywhere is sort of what those people were about. It was wonderful. So I believe in entrepreneurs. I'm a Silicon Valley person. And so I want to come up underneath people as government and lift the people and have safety nets. That's what I hope for government. So we want to teach the new ways that we use the internet, how we write Wikipedia, how you, when we first met, you know, everybody's talking and talking and talking about how we were going to start teaching. You just started teaching. I love that.
For those of y'all who don't know, Megan was actually deeply involved in Khan Academy existing. In 2010, when I was operating out of a walk-in closet, you were part of the Google team, I believe.
Yeah, for the 10th birthday of Google, we had $10 million that some people thought, let's put this up and ask the world, what do you want solved with this money? Suggest things, and we'll try to find organizations and make some grants to them. And there were a lot of suggestions, 150,000 suggestions. We turned those into 16 categories. The world voted the top five. One of them included universal access to education. And we looked around the world, and there you were. And you were the best thing that we saw
that
at the time. And so we got the money.
I got this mysterious invitation from y'all, and you brought me into a conference room. And someone said, what would you do with $2 million?
Yeah.
And I remember saying, well, you know, is this an open question? Because, you know, I could... There's a lot that you could do with $2 million. But yeah, and I mean, it's amazing, and we've known each other well since then.
And that started a revolution, which you know, your work and then all the other work that's come from that. And actually, I just met some students. You have a lab school now.
We started a little school under our offices to try out new things, and yeah, some of the students are here.
Yeah, awesome.
So this is actually a good segue to knowing you more as a person, mm-hmm, kind of how you got started. You know, where when you were growing up, what did you think you were going to be? Did you say, I'm going to be the chief technology officer of the United States of America?
Yeah, right away. I used to tell my dad that. Now, I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and my parents were very entrepreneurial people. My dad started the recycling center. In fact, there's a funny story about him. My dad's not alive anymore, and at his memorial service, a friend Mark said, he was 14, my dad pulled up in, of course, our VW bus van, full of what Mark said looked like garbage, and off they went to recycle. And my dad, I guess, looked at them as they were sorting brown glass and green glass, as you did in those days, and he said, you know, someday everyone's going to do this. And he was like that. My dad was like that. He was amazing. And my mom started the bicycle club, and they did the bike routes, and they were sort of these activist, very passionate people about the community, and I learned that from them. And then I went to an amazing school, an inner city school. We had no money, but we had astonishing teachers. And one of the most important things for me was that science fair was mandatory. And we also got drafted for the math team. So we just had to do these things. Yeah. Mr. Soffman and Mr. Keen, so you will do this. And so we found out it was fun. And I think a lot of kids don't know, because I wish that school worked more like PE, you know, and it was active. And so you went and you played at not only baseball, but you played at discovery, and then you got some instruction. And you played, I brought the Raspberry Pi out here. You know, all the kids should know what's inside their cell phone. And
we were joking in the green room that you just like to be surrounding yourself with
stuff.
Circuit boards.
I love circuit boards. Chips. So, you know, kids should know this. And if anybody has fun ideas for Internet of Things and sensors, it's the 100-year anniversary of the national parks, which is so exciting. And we're really focused on getting every child in a park, especially pedagogically, the fourth graders. And so I thought for...
Why fourth graders?
I don't know. Our education colleagues said that's a particular year that matters for them to go. I buy it.
Yeah.
I think any year's good. No, yeah, they want any year, but they're focused on fourth. But I really was hoping for CS Education Week, which is... Do people know that it's located second week of December because of Grace Hopper and Ada Lovelace's birthdays, which are the 9th and 10th of December?
The founding mothers of programming. Very few people realize
that. Yeah. So Ada in the 1800s invented the idea of programmability. Byron's poet math daughter, yeah, amazing person. And then Grace Hopper, who was a rear admiral in the Navy, was tired of machine language and thought there's got to be a way, and came up with a compiler or a translator and started to write in human language, eventually COBOL, what became Java, and Perl. And so we celebrate Computer Science Education Week, and we hope that all children in our country, that we can keep pushing. We're a very federated, decentralized education system, as you know, and so we're really collaborating with lots of people. New York City has a wonderful announcement about computer science for all kids and coding, but we want that to happen. And my hope for this one is that we actually do kids in the parks with sensors and coding and data science for this December. So anybody who's got stuff like that, I'd love to hear from you.
Data science in the
data
park.
Data science
I
in
like
the park
that.
With the kids.
And, you know,
Teddy Roosevelt would love it.
And going back to, you know, your formative years, it sounds like you had a really great high school, a really great set of teachers. Mm-hmm. Was it then that you said, technology is for me, math and science is for me? Was that, and then you go on to MIT?
Yeah, so I think that all the research shows, and it's clear this happened to me, the kids don't get into it unless they try it. They need to experience it and understand that the confidence that they can do it and that it's fun. That it's not just, you know, sometimes the way that we teach science and math, it's sort of boring and intimidating. And so the kids try to move back. But if they're passionately doing something, at the time, Jimmy Carter was putting solar panels on the White House. And it was fun to see President Obama on top of the Department of Energy putting solar panels coming like Back to the Future. you know, we had an energy crisis, and I learned that you could solve real problems. The impact, so kids need to know impact. I learned that, and I got to experience it myself. And so it was a great thing. And so I learned that I love to help make the world a better place using science and tech and innovation and empowering others to do the same.
And in the tech sector, you know, something that a lot of folks have been talking about for some time, and I know this is a passion of yours as well, is this imbalance. It's, you know, it seems like a male-dominated field. You know, if you look at engineering schools, if you look at Silicon Valley, what's your diagnosis of why that is? And what, despite that, kind of allowed Megan Smith to become Megan Smith?
Yeah, my school was very diverse. I guess we were probably maybe 40% Caucasian kids, 40% African American kids, Hispanic kids, Asian kids. So the world I was in was a very balanced place when I was younger. And as we know, tech sort of, it's an interesting thing. We need to really work on our culture and our unconscious bias, because I think there's not a lot of overt bias, but it's kind of death by a thousand cuts. Just that little thing where the guys are just rising and the women are rising slower just because of perception. Same thing with people of color. We really have to work on that. And it's interesting to watch companies, because some companies, it's in the top 20. Of course it's important to everybody. But I love what Intel is starting to do. They've put it in maybe the top two or three. And as we do that in Silicon Valley, it's going to really help us. It's actually quite profitable to have a diverse team. All the metrics show that. And so we need to get it done. We're wasting a lot of talent in the country.
And the argument, which makes all the sense in the world why it is profitable, is you're making products and services for everyone.
Right.
Not just the people that look like yourself.
And you think more creatively as a broad team. And the math, there's a lot of research out there. President just hosted, he just hosted the first ever White House Demo Day. So we're trying to bring these new practices. And we had 90 entrepreneurs from across the country, from 30 different companies, from Wisconsin, Mississippi, as well as Silicon Valley and Boston and Austin. Wonderful entrepreneurs solving problems and really role modeling. You know, in typical Demo Day, you're deciding who gets funding. This was more role modeling the story of an entrepreneur, which is such a great American story for all time. Yeah. And so let's make sure everybody's having those experiences. The president has the My Brother's Keeper initiative. You know, it's crazy that one in three African American boys are going to jail. It's unacceptable. And so, yeah. And it's interesting to think about Baltimore, because in Baltimore is the team, and we're the first country in the world to visit all planets and one maybe sort of planet, Pluto. Right? So part of that team is in Baltimore. And yet in Raj Chetty, who's a researcher and from Harvard, goes into the IRS database and asks questions. He's doing this great research for the poorest Americans. So $12,000, $14,000 annual income. Does place matter? And it turns out that it does, and you can make 40% less money or 40% more depending on where. Guess where the worst place to live is in his research? Baltimore. Hmm. So how is it within 5 or 10 miles that this is happening? And what are we doing to reach the communities and bridge that? So last summer, you know, with getting the summer jobs going, getting tech hire going, working on bridging communities, it's interesting to notice like the tech meetups that we're all part of. They're really invisible to most people in our cities, and we really need to take your neighbor's kid to work day and take your neighbor to work.
Yeah.
You know, and we're trying to cause that to happen. We hosted the first ever White House tech meetup, and so we had all the best meetup organizers from half from the country and all these other people who have these great youth programs and other kinds of inclusion programs. They could learn each other's practices. So I really believe that it's in the ecosystem. And like we have here in Silicon Valley, so amazing to be part of this ecosystem. It has serious issues around diversity and unconscious bias, but it is welcoming. It's trying to be that way.
I mean, you mentioned one of the tangible things that leaders and probably a lot of folks in this room could do to help address it is take it from number 20 to number 3 in the priority. But how do you make sure that that's just not window dressing? Like, what tangibly should people do to change, and it could be something that they change at the hiring level or at the right. Silicon Valley level, or earlier on, you know, take your neighbor or your neighbor's neighbor's right. neighbor to work. What are your ideas there?
I think you need to go find the populations and recruit them. You know, whether it's looking around your city and where are people working. I was just with the economist of the NAACP, and he was showing how there's a very large number of, for example, African-American computer science graduates. And yet they are tracking into more of, say, a DMV coding job and not our coding jobs. Let's go to the DMV and like get them to come to our companies. You know, what are we doing to really pay attention to these talent? We were just down in Atlanta, where there's an incredible African-American entrepreneurial community to try to recruit for the digital service. The president's team is the most diverse team I have ever worked on. It's astonishing, and it's so exciting to work in that kind of environment. And so we want to do right by him and his vision and what the work he's done, and make sure that the U.S. Digital Service and 18F and Team CTO and these other teams are as diverse as those teams and as welcoming for all Americans. I think Lou Gerstner from IBM really role modeled something great, which was his immediate leadership team was not diverse, but he reached into the community in his company and he asked the IBMers to meet. And he said, okay, for the LGBT IBMers, women, African Americans, veterans, others, come together, tell me, how do I get more employees, customers, and suppliers from your community? And how do I help you thrive and rise at IBM?
Yeah.
And then he asked each of his management team to adopt one of them and go to their events and be with them, and then we're going to talk about it every week. And it really changed the company, and IBM is one of the more welcoming companies for people.
Yeah.
And I see Intel stepping into those shoes now, which is really exciting to watch. They have set a goal to match the American population by 5 years from now, which
wow.
is awesome. And they claim to be on track, which sounds incredible.
Wow. And just going back to your narrative, because I think it ties so much with everything we're talking about. You know, you come out of college, and you know, I'm going to jump around a little bit, but you were the CEO of Planet Out.
Yep.
You join Google.
Uh-huh.
You become one of the leaders in Google. Many, many accomplishments, one of which is funding Khan Academy.
Yeah.
What made you say, I want to work in government?
Yeah, so you and I have both had the honor of giving the MIT commencement address, and I did that this in June. And one of the things I said to them, you know, I was like, why did I go to government? You know, it's incredible to be asked to go serve for the U.S. government. And
how does that happen? Does, you know, the president...
I was in Africa, and I got an email from Todd Park.
Okay, all right.
I was in Kenya and Uganda working with the invisible to some of the community techies who are there. And we got to work on bridging. 33 days later, the president called and asked me to come to D.C.
And how does he call? I'm just curious. Does, like, he just, like, is it, like, the phone rings and did you know it's going to be the president?
I knew he was going to call.
Like, someone calls ahead of time.
Yes.
And says, the president's about to call you.
Yes.
And then you answer and you
then
say,
you answer and,
hello.
Megan, this is Barack. And I'm like,
he
yes,
says Barack.
He did.
Very
me.
Informal.
And I said, yes, Mr. President.
Yeah, and he said, would you like to be the CTO?
He said, I want you to come.
And what did you, and you said?
I said, it would be an honor, Mr. President.
Okay, so it's just a straight up.
Yeah. Straight up.
He's
an amazing person. And sometimes we come back from meetings and, you know, you can't know every topic, right? So we'll come in and we'll be briefing him or talking and brainstorming. And DJ Patil, who's the U.S. Chief Data Scientist, came back from a precision medicine meeting the other day. He's like, yeah, we were talking to him and he was behind us. And then by the end of the meeting, he lapped us 4 times.
Yeah, just in terms of knowledge.
He's so smart. Yeah, and just really, Dr. Holdren said this to me, that when we were in meetings with him, just he's really able to incisively look at where the challenges are and guide people. He's an amazing leader. It's great to work with them. But the point I was making about the MIT point is, from commencement, is we techies are, it's fun when we're, say, in our MIT mode or where we're with each other, we're here in Silicon Valley, we should do that. We advance the field. But we also need to go places where we're very rare, because our teammates, who are amazing also, in their right, need us badly. And right now, they need us a lot. And Todd Park has been here in Silicon Valley recruiting. We've already got more than 300 people who've come in the last year from Amazon, Facebook, Twitter, Dropbox, WordPress, just incredible, elite, top Americans. We really want to have tours of duty. We hope many of you will come and consider serving. It could be 6 months. It could be 4 years. It could be even a two-week sprint. It could be even, you know, coming into the APIs and open source work. But the government and the country is what we make of it and how we show up. And from the beginning of the country, we have leveraged technology. President Washington, before the founding of the country, started the Army Corps of Engineers. They wear this super cool little pin, and it's Bunker Fort. It's the first thing they built. And so we've always had engineering and design and as part of us, and it goes up and down. When we're at war, it gets very expansive. But we need to take this opportunity, and now is the digital time.
And what would you say to folks in the audience or in Silicon Valley broadly, or in tech broadly?
Yeah.
Would say, that sounds nice, but you know, DC looks like there's a lot of bickering. It looks really bureaucratic. I'm here in Silicon Valley. I can, you know, hack all night with some friends, create the new shared economy app. That's going to change the world. Go get some venture funding. That's the vector to change the world. Not. What would you say to them?
I understand that because I've done that, and I think people should continue to do things like whatever they're passionate to do. You know, founders, it's in us to do things. At the same time, as the World Bank just published an amazing report earlier this week called Digital Dividends, and it really shows that we're going to divide our societies more and more if we don't add, they call it analog components or the non-digital components, if we don't get the digital stuff moving there and inclusion, you know, making sure that when our amazing teammates are working on connectivity, we've got the techies, the fiber backhaul people in the conversation, you know, to make sure the last bits work. If we don't do that, we'll just make our society, you know, a bad society. And we're better than that. This country is better than that and the vision of this country. And so in order to form a more perfect union, it includes us, you know,
really?
And we need to show up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's actually incredibly fun.
It's fun.
Weaver, he's in the U.S. Digital Service in the VA. He's like, this is the hardest, craziest thing. But it's awesome because you're working for the American veterans. We have the number 3 employee of Amazon in the VA. Kathy Pham is here, who's in the VA. They're working on the backlog. They're working on interop of health. I mean, the American veterans really deserve us to come. In fact, Kathy was in the First Lady's box because her brother is in the military. He's an officer in the military. And between the two of them, military service and digital service.
Yeah.
And that's a new model that we have. And we want to make sure people can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, as the CTO, you know, there's a lot of very technology-focused issues facing the country.
Yeah.
You know, one of them that I know you've been deeply involved, net neutrality. You've played a big role in keeping the net neutral.
Yeah. The president has done that. Yeah.
What is a quick, for folks who don't understand what net neutrality is and the importance of having kept it neutral, which you played a big role, and the president, what is that?
The leader on net neutrality, he said from the time he was a candidate, he came to understand the issues and really always supported it. And
it's the idea that when these packets go on the internet, if
there's not like toll lanes for some people that you know that there's not fast track lanes for certain payments and etc.
Right.
So we're in what's important. You have economists, you have all the different lawyers, different people, but we want the computer scientists at that table to talk about the architecture of the web and why it's important to separate those layers and make sure that we can have the kind of internet that we want. Same thing around encryption or patent reform or copyright, just this TQ, tech quotient. Yeah.
Tech quotient.
Which we hope everyone will have, and that's we're doing a lot of work around STEM education and computer science and that, but tech quotient at the table is what we're trying to bring.
And what's your view? I mean, this is something where I think Silicon Valley and Washington, at least, you know, as a civilian, it feels like they're a little bit at loggerheads on, is the notions of privacy. You were a senior executive at Google. Mm-hmm. You know, all of these things have come out about, you know, the NSA and whatnot. And what's your view there? What obligation does a private company have towards sharing with the government for national security? Where should the government draw the line and, you know, not put pressure?
Yeah, so I don't work specifically on those issues, but I think that it's interesting to watch how, you know, the president, you know, the review that happened after some of the different events that occurred, the teams really went in and tried to say, okay, how should we be exactly? How should we sort of evolve these policies so we can keep the American people safe and do what we need to do, what's within the law, what's not within the law, and those works. So I think people are doing an excellent job of just trying to walk the line of security. And it's a conversation where I think this is a really good example where having technical people in the room is critical. Because if we're not there, it's hard for people to make these decisions and to walk the right way. So it's an important part of our government, and being there is key.
And I completely agree. And I mean, and a very related thing, I mean, you always hear about, you know, China having a professional, you know, hacker army and Russia and all of these things. And I know this isn't directly under your, you know, you're not part of the cyber
command. We don't operate the IT or cyber, but we're trying to bring best practice.
I mean, what... How seriously should, as citizens, we should be thinking about this, and how much is, and maybe is that part of the pitch to get more people? It's not
yes.
just to kind of help the country, it's to protect the country.
Definitely. And I think that this is not unique. We at the UN, this is a big topic. This is not a unique American issue. You know, I was at Google when we experienced a lot of break-ins, and people found that, you know, 100 companies had been broken in for IP. So I think that we need to, there's great people working on this issue. The president held a cyber summit here in Silicon Valley at Stanford. So both the federal government's work, and also the work across business and sharing information, et cetera. The more creativity we can put on that, the better. We have good people on it, but let's keep piling on because they're piling on. I actually think back to diversity, it's one of the most strategic advantages we have as a company, as a country. That we have Americans, you know, who were always here, to Americans who had just arrived today. And we draw from the whole world. And the more that we're inclusive, the more creative not only our economic, you know, our solutions and the economy and the products that we make will be and to serve, but also on this kind of a topic, the sort of creativity and brilliance we will be to fight cyber attacks is right there. You know, sort of that's an advantage that we have with our way of life and with our inclusivity. We can turn that around and keep using that.
Yeah, yeah. So we're going to have questions in 5 minutes, so I encourage everyone in the audience to start thinking of their questions and questions, not speeches. you know, kind of a final question or thought, what are you most excited about in the near term and long term, and maybe what are you most worried about?
I think it's so exciting right now. You know, it was interesting that I was in Africa when I got asked to come do this job, to consider it. And because I actually think Africa will be one of the most profound changes we're going to see. There's 900 million people who've been basically locked out of the global conversation who are going to rise, and that talent will join us. And it's just, this talent is, you know, lifting. And so I'm a card-carrying optimist, and so I really believe in the potential future. We were in Afghanistan when I was at Google, and one of the guys who was doing security with us, he said every time they were landing in Kandahar, this little boy would run out of his house and lie on the roof. And he was trying to figure out why he was doing that. And so one day he was near them, and he went over, and the boy was running out of his house to lie on the roof to protect the solar panel so that they would have their electricity. You know, and I think there's brilliant, great people everywhere, and opportunity hasn't been equal, and that's changing. And, you know, again, back to the UN this weekend, you can see this change that's happening. And the internet, sometimes I think, you know, we talk about singularity, and that sometimes I love to think about the great plurality, the talent of all of us, and what happens when people bring their passion and the talent you're unlocking, you know, by teaching. And letting people engage with that, I think that's really exciting. On the scary side, I think, you know, when like ISIL type mentality, bigotry, bullying, lack of empathy for each other. You know, my brother converted to Islam. He's an amazing chip designer at IBM, and kind of the hatred he gets is really frustrating. So I think that we need to continue to do what our founders set up out to do, and they were not perfect. They left women out, they left people of color, they were awful to Native Americans, but they had an idea that worked at the way the thinking worked at that time. And there's a wonderful Jefferson quote that's in the memorial, and it said, you know, he's not a fan, I'll get it not exactly right, but he's not a fan of the rapid change of law. But when the human mind...
The rapid change of law.
But when the human mind moves forward in our understanding, you know, we need to change. And it's much like you can't put on the jacket you wore as a boy, right? And so we come to understand racism and work to stop that. We come to understand sexism. We work to stop that. LGBT bigotry, you know, we're in the middle of learning that right now. Lots of conversations. I have the honor to interview Edie Windsor, Windsor v. United States, this on Friday in New York City, who won the DOMA case. So we're evolving, and I think that's really exciting. And at the same time, when we devolve, it's frustrating and scary and really devastating, you know, to see that. And so we have to work together. Prime Minister Cameron made an incredible speech during the countering extremism ISIL conversation about extremism. And that, you know, these awful events start, you know, you step back from them and you see what are the events by which that boy or girl, that person who's grown up and doing that horrible act, how did they get there and what can we do to change that? How do we fail them? I was lucky once to meet the mother of the 20th hijacker, 9/11, an amazing woman. She was married as a 14-year-old, forced to marry his father in Morocco, moved eventually to Paris. And she watched you know, him as a teenager just be treated as second class. And as he became radicalized, trying to figure out how to help him. We need to figure that out together and be more inclusive and more loving of each other, and bring our neighbors to work and bring our neighbors to, you know, to the dinner table and have these conversations so that less people get into that situation. And those people, maybe we need to, you know, have prison or other things for those folks until they can figure it out. But most folks, we're failing them and we need to figure out not to do that.
And you've even been a part of this where even prior to becoming CTO, you were one of the co-founders of the Malala Fund. A lot of people don't know that.
Yeah, so I believe in entrepreneurs. And when Malala was shot, it was so devastating, of course, for all of us. And we understood. And so as it became clear that she would be well, we just got on the internet and started to flash mob, as we do, to come underneath her so she would have a platform. I don't know how to fix Pakistan, but Malala and her father seem to have a pretty good idea, and her mother and her family. So how can I support them? And that was the idea of the Malala Fund. Then we came together to sort of raise some early money for that. And now, I mean, she's just amazing. Yeah.
So. And quick, I mean, when we were walking
And by the way, her favorite subject is physics.
Physics.
So how about like one child, one teacher, one book, one pen, enjoying Raspberry Pi and discovery and making and coding and making the world better because we get them access to passionate, exciting learning opportunities.
I'd love to do some physics videos with her.
That would be good.
So I think we're...
In the new movie, she talks about quarks. That's a little clue for you.
Wow. So we're ready now for questions. Where's the microphones? Okay, the first question is over here. I'll let the folks with the...
Thank you, and thank you both for being here. This is very exciting. Jeanette Shaw with Techology. A lot of states have regulatory institutions in place that don't allow for new embedded creations such as hacker schools or coding schools. Is the administration in your office going to help with those of us who are in those states to help minimize those regulations so we can ensure that women and the color community will actually get into the schools, will work for companies like Google, Facebook, and so forth?
Yeah, definitely. Critically important. There's this wonderful innovation of these code boot camps, so where you can go for 3 months. In fact, Flatiron taught a wonderful one for teachers. They said it's easy to learn coding, it's hard to learn to teach, so they needed more teachers, and they thought they could attract teachers for summer jobs. And so they taught, I think it was 100 hours of coding that you could do in a cohort, or you could do it just online, and then 1 week of intensive learning how to teach code. So really great programs that are out there. We want to make sure that these become available. When we launched the Tech Hire Initiative with the president, which is this idea of code boot camps and getting the employers to become capable of reading a resume like that, that's hard to learn how to qualify someone using portfolio, but people are starting to do it. A great thing happened where the boot camps themselves came together to look at the quality control, and really we've had some educational institutions who have not done well by their students, and so these guys are really looking at how can I tell you this is the price and this is the outcome from most of our students are getting this kind of a job with this kind of pay. So that was a terrific development. A lot of the community colleges are trying to pull some of these onto campus. So we're working as hard as we can with different institutions trying to make sure that this kind of a learning opportunity is available. Also the maker spaces and start spaces, sharing spaces, getting these into campuses so the students can be doing this sort of active learning. We lose about 40% of our students from freshman year to senior year in STEM, which is crazy, and it's because we have these big lecture classes freshman year, and so it's boring and intimidating, and they don't get to do the fun till senior year, so we want to pull research and active learning and maker spaces and design experience into freshman year. We're going to make a very big push this year on that. So it's really about getting these new modern ways in, and it's fun to see, it's fabulous to see the educational institutions start to pull it in. So I'd love to hear any specifics you're hearing, because the more we hear the specifics, the more we can go in and debug that and then try to scale it.
Hey, we're on the very top floor, the very back.
Hello. Yay.
Hello from above. Thank you. So my question to you is in regards to, you're doing a great job changing government and adding technology. One part of government, from what I understand, is woefully behind everybody else, and that's Congress. You know, no iPads on the floor. They can't use the internet to poll their constituents. And some of these great senators even admit to not even ever using email. So how can you, in your role, help facilitate change in this part of government that seems not to want to change with the rest of America?
So I have good news. I was just over at the Code for America Summit, and I just want to honor Jen Palka, who founded Code for America. Amazing, amazing leader. She came into the CTO's office, actually, when Todd was there and was deputy CTO, and she and Haley Van Dyke and Jeff Zients, who's now the National Economic Council, Tom Cleo and others, structured what is now the U.S. Digital Service embedded at OMB. But the reason why I bring up Code for America is because there's this fabulous group of innovators over there, including one who told me that the Congressional Innovation Fellows call is going to go out shortly. So that's the beginning of that change, too, just like the Presidential Innovation Fellows began to open the door, like the president's done for us, opening the door for our community to come to government. I think that's a great development for Congress to bring us in there and see what we can do. You know, it's our government together. And so we need access to, and we need to go in and solve things in the way that we do that together with colleagues. And it'll be a heavy lift, but it'll be exciting, and I'm an optimist, so I believe it's possible.
All right, right back here to the front and center.
Hi, Megan. I guess you mentioned a little bit about the prison state issue and how that's been growing. Any thoughts on how decriminalization of drugs and or providing more mental health kind of issues can help resolve that? And what's particularly the president's perspective on decriminalizing drugs to help reduce prison?
So the president's the first president to go to a prison, I guess, you know, when he went to the prison visit earlier this year. This is an area that launching the policing task force and really diving into these issues, it's crazy that we have 25% of the world's prison population in this country. And it's devastating for the people who are in that situation. It's devastating for their families. It's terrible economically. But the good news is that people are doing a lot of great work. There's a group in the Domestic Policy Council that Cecilia Munoz runs that's social civic innovation. We're doing a lot of paper performance work. So, for example, a Rikers pilot, we're just adding a little bit of pay it forward money so that the folks who are incarcerated can do some job training and some sort of development and psychology work, which drastically reduces the recidivism. So that's a great thing to be doing. We launched something called the Police Data Initiative, which is getting people collaborating around open data and about policing data to try to debug some of that. There's now 21, just like TechHire, 21 communities working in that area. Kind of turning our attention to, again, we often take this scouting mentality. We feel like there's someone in the country who probably has something solved. So on October 28th, we're going to be hosting a sort of criminal justice / social justice innovation meeting at the White House, where we're looking for about 40, 45 different communities who have solutions. There's a group in Kansas that San Diego did an amazing job where they worked with the 35 homeless folks who most use the system, ambulance roles, addiction issues, those areas, and work together in almost a concierge service. Interestingly, the UK has just identified the top 100,000 families who are in the worst, who are using the services the most and need the most help, and are really developing kind of the head of the tail, like a concierge service to really reach in and help those families. So who's doing that well around the country? How do we bring them together and learn from each other? And then try to see what's scalable and then get all the communities to know about that and really do that work. So we need to work together to solve this problem, and we need to work quickly. It's incredibly unfair and it's terrible policy. And I think the president's leadership here is excellent, and he's pushing us hard to work on these issues. DJ Patil, who I mentioned, is the US Chief Data Scientist. The president asked him to work on precision medicine or personalized health and interop as three projects. Second project, we've chosen this criminal justice and social justice area of data interop. And the third one is just capacity building across the board of data science in the government, including data and discrimination and what we can understand policy-wise around those areas. And if anybody has ideas, we welcome folks to come and join us. If you have a working project like the Solution Summit in these areas, we'd love to welcome that and share those ideas.
Hi, we're upstairs at the Loge to the very right.
Over here. Okay. Oh, there you are.
Hi, my name's Julia Kahn, and I'm a senior at Los Altos High School, and I was wondering if you had any advice how we as students can encourage this entrepreneurial spirit in other students.
Yeah, it's amazing to watch the youth of today and the things you guys are doing. We want you to kind of get into your cell phones and start understanding the details of what is in there. So that's one piece. Play with and get into the technology, figure out how to code and do things. But I think it's a lot like the experience we have here in Silicon Valley. Come together and talk to each other about what you're passionate about changing in the world. What do you want to do? What's interesting to you? What's exciting? I was lucky to take acoustics from Professor Bose, the speaker guy. It was an amazing thing, and his advice, amazing. Did you take that class?
I couldn't get in.
Oh, come on. Why couldn't you get in? It was super popular.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
It was. I'm sure it was.
Yeah. I'm sure I have my notes somewhere. Yeah. I'll lend them to you. Okay. He's incredible, and he always said to us, follow your passion, find the thing you're interested in. And I think for young people, sometimes there's a lot of rules around. You know, there's 7 billion people on the planet doing all kinds of different things. There's all kinds of ways. So talk to each other. You know, run a startup weekend or evening with each other. Sort of what might you make? What might you do? What might you solve? And just start building stuff together. You know, it could be you might want to make a movie together, you might want to make a tech company, you might want an app to solve something. You know, maybe even look at these new 17 sustainable development goals and what's interesting to you guys. And really support each other in doing that. That's what I think. I wish that high schools all had entrepreneurship classes and that's how we did things. You know, that you could make stuff as part of your learning. And I think we have such extraordinary teachers out there. I got to give them medals for the science and technology medals for our teachers, 2 per state this year. Amazing, amazing people. And I wanna, it's sort of like I thought about the movie Waiting for Superman. I'm like, here they are, and women. You know, they were amazing people. And so diving into those teachers and getting first robotics and entrepreneurial experiences, that's what I recommend for you guys. And follow your heart.
Thank you.
All right, we're coming right back to the front again.
Hi, my name is Annie, and my question is based on with the upcoming presidential elections, a lot of presidents are discussing nationwide issues. However, none of them are articulating a digital strategy. So as a CTO of the United States, how do you plan to bring this to their radar?
We have a Hatch Act that doesn't let me talk to them, so I will not talk to them. Later, as we get closer to the elections, there's some rules, and I'll talk to our legal folks about how we do that. But there's a point, there's a group that starts briefing and talking as we go into transition. It is amazing to be part of learning how our government transitions. I mean, we've been doing this for hundreds of years, and I watch people come in and out of government all the time, or the teams come, and just even short tours of duty can be amazing things. And so I really believe that this digital work that we're doing is incredibly bipartisan. It's long in coming. You know, we're going to save so much money by doing things in these new modern sort of open source ways, with the stuff that we pay for writing and with the amazing stuff that the incredible tech community brings. It'll be their choice on open source. I think people, practice makes permanent, and the more we do these things with the different groups, people love it. And it's really empowering. The people in the government are very mission-driven. You know, whether state or local, they've just had very difficult tools to be working with for a long time. And as we can come in and fix these things, you know, it's just a joyful thing. My boys, we have two boys, they're 13 and 10. And when they were in third grade, their teacher had this amazing thing on the wall. It said, "In effort, there's joy." And I think that all of us, you know, we're so crazy passionate folks. So are the feds. You know, and they really want to serve the American people. And so it's helpful to show up. I feel like they have these beautiful cars, and we come in and pump up the tires, and they go, you know. And so I think it's here to stay. The internet's here to stay. I think the digital teams are here to stay. And I'm hopeful about that.
We have one more question.
Yeah.
Where is the microphone?
Oh,
yes.
So my name is Timothy, and my question is, you mentioned that 20% of the world population does not have access to technology, and in this, with the development going on, it's crucial that kids from younger ages can have access. So how do you think that you can deal with that?
Yeah, one of the things, that's a fabulous question, and how old are you? You're 10, awesome. My son, yeah. I think that what my hope is that all parents would be as cool as your parents and bring them to all kinds of interesting things for them. This is fun to meet you. And, you know, include kids. We take our kids as many places as we can, so inclusiveness like that. But we were talking about connectivity. And, you know, I really believe it's one of the most extraordinary things to have the internet, the plurality of us. And so there are some fundamental things, connectivity and education and access and empathy and caring. As the technical person, what I can do for my colleagues who are the policy teammates on connectivity is I can find colleagues who really understand the network of the earth and where the undersea cables are and how fiber works and backhaul and the backbone of society, and get them to come to the table. And we're working on recruiting some folks like that right now, because it would be great to draw maps together with our policy docs for all of these countries together and really have a plan. You know, it's amazing to me that from my colleagues, and I don't have this in detail, but from talking to connectivity colleagues, it might cost about $500 million or $1 billion to have all of Afghanistan fiber, right? So we spent $8 billion a month for a long time, and I wish that we would have prioritized
and
that
repeat
connectivity.
That again. Repeat that again. For many years, just the military presence in Afghanistan was, what you said, $8 billion a month.
Right. And
for half of that.
In a very difficult situation, and for sort of $500 million or $1 billion.
$500 million. Okay.
We could have, fibered that country. Afghanistan, to your point about young people, I think 60% of the country is 20 years old and younger. So they really deserve to have that future. And I got to go there. I was in Herat with our techies. And the boy I mentioned with the solar panel, he and his sister deserve that. And so we have to get that done. And so
what would that same number be in the U.S. if we wanted to get fiber to the 30% that don't have it?
I don't know. That's why we're recruiting these folks, because we want, when we're knowing, I want someone to tell us those things and how we work with, where is the, especially for countries like Afghanistan or Liberia, probably we want to do a little bit of funding, whether it's a loan funding or something, to jumpstart some fiber access and let the, you know, the rest of the private industry take over.
But the big takeaway is for literally a fraction of the cost of these military presences for a month.
Right.
You could wire an entire country.
So we're working on the USAID team, the Global Development Lab, has the West Africa project right now. Because somebody did a sketch, see if you can find the right tech person, a sketch for Liberia saying probably $21 million to run the core backbone fiber. So let's say it's double that. That's not that much money. And then it's the size of Virginia. So let's do that. And so it's about sort of finding each person with their talent and getting them connected to the problems that we need to solve, and using now this wonderful internet that we have, which isn't a bunch of wires and things, although it is. It's actually just us, you know, together, you know, empowering each other in the ways that each individual's passionate about.
Absolutely. And you know, just to finish off, as a bit of a Commonwealth Club tradition, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Wow. I really believe in unlocking talent. And so anything anyone can do to just give other people access to voice and to unlock their passion, because we have so many problems in the world and people are interested in so many things. The more people we have as teammates to solve things, whether they're youth or whether they're in a poor country or whether they're, you know, right next to you, helping empower them and thinking of everyone as an entrepreneur for the things they're passionate about really can change the world. And paying attention to empathy and caring and kindness as part of that is critical.
Megan Smith, CTO of the United States of America.